Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Monday, 23rd of November, 2020. And we had a bit of an odd close into the session on Friday where we saw US equity suddenly selling off, but that didn't seem to provide any sort of impetus into the beginning of the week. Things looking pretty much up. If we look at where we are tactically in terms of the big market itself in the US, just stuck in that range. It's the same chart we're recycling for the last two or three days here. Really a zone of uncertainty below, let's call it 3600 and above 3500 until we know next steps. But in the meantime, Asia in a pretty solid session. It wasn't across the board, although Japan was off. That's probably why I was seeing Japan not registering a positive return, because that was not the Monday session. But Peter, you're also pointing out, talking about Asia and where people are focusing, some pretty good data out of South Korea, which is considered a very sensitive cyclical economy.
Yeah, so we are up 2% in South Korean equity futures. We are 1.5% high in Chinese equity futures and 1% in Europe, obviously with their strong link to Asia growth. And then the US is trailing with only 0.5% up in S&P 500 futures and 0.2% in technology. So it seems like we're starting this week on a new try, I would say, on the value / pro-cyclical rotation in equities. We're trying again. And it's all, I think it's most of it is down to what happened over the weekend, as you sort of alluded to, which you can see on slide 3. So the South Korean exports tallying up the first 20 days on a year-to-year basis was 11.1%. So almost reaching the same growth rate just prior to the big plunge from the COVID-19 lockups and restrictions around the world. And that was against an estimated 6% decline year-on-year. So a massive be there from South Korea. And I think it's bolstering this view that Asia is really beginning to heat up. It's beginning to also with South Korea, it's a much more industrial focused. It's automobiles, it's shipyards, it's semiconductors, it's TV screens. It's all that is pro-cyclical. That's also why South Korea is often part of the leading indicators for the global economy. To top it off, as we talked about last week, I mean, we know China is running a very tight financial conditions, especially on the monetary side. And our expectation is also probably given what we have witnessed over the past couple of days, John, with that default on a corporate bond in China, that they probably will move to a more easing stance in China. And with that, I think we could see positive markets for the months to come. And I'm quite positive on emerging markets, but I can talk a little bit more in depth in a few minutes on that one.
Yeah, at the top of the range there for emerging markets there on slide 4. Ole, and it looks like to me the oil market seems to be giving a vote of confidence. You had interesting comments though on the internal call about if you look at Brent, we're towards the top of the range for the front month where we've been for the last many months. But I thought you, at least as far as I understood, you have some concerns on the supply side in the U.S. at least.
Yeah, exactly, John, and it's just highlighting what we this battle we have right now, where the where everyone basically wants to just forget about the present and move into the future, where the vaccine is going to save us all and we can return to normal. The commodity market is obviously also reacting to this, and we've seen oil markets move higher over the past few weeks here after hitting a low in early November. The problem with that, as we highlighted on several occasions, is that there's still too much supply in the market. So even though the market is moving higher on expectations of a pickup in demand, we also have to deal with the present situation where the demand is not strong enough due to all the lockdowns we have around the world. And that's basically been reflected in the inventory levels that we're currently seeing at Cushing. Remember, maybe you don't, but back in April when crude oil collapsed into negative territory, it was the rapid rise in inventories at Cushing that spooked the market and basically left the market worried that there wasn't going to be any storage capacity left, and that basically means the price of oil was worth nothing. This is not the situation we're seeing this time around, but it's just still highlighting the fact that even though the market prices are going up because we're expecting a recovery, at the same time, stocks are going up as well because that recovery is still not around the corner. We probably need to go into 2021. So where does that leave the oil price? Well, we're testing now that 46 or getting close to 46, the August peak. I think 46 and a half was where we peaked out, and that obviously will create some additional headlines if we should break through that level. But we just have to stay focused on the fact that we still got lockdowns, we still got fuel demand, which is struggling to recover, and we need to get into 21 before that really picks up in earnest.
Yeah, but I think it's on the demand side. So we know the supply side is getting stretched on the wrong side. But on the demand side, there was this very big survey coming out from CBRE, the big real estate agent in, I was thinking also they had own real estates in the US, but they ran this very massive survey in the US where they surveyed US workers around what they would like to see in their work life after the COVID-19, even with the vaccines. And it was staggering amounts. I mean, 75% of all respondents said that they wanted at least 2 days of working from home, yeah, and potentially 3 and 4 days working from home. So there seems to be a very big urge, at least from U.S. workers, that they want more flexibility. And I'm just wondering what it does to, you know, demand for mobility services, but also real estate. But that's a different story. But I just think that I don't think we're out of the woods. We don't actually know exactly where demand will be in 2021, even if the economy heats up.
Absolutely, again. Peter. And it actually, I think over the weekend, the mayor of London expressed exactly the same, those worries that he was very worried about the city of London and the city, basically the center of London going forward, because UK have been through some extended lockdowns, and a lot of these workers, they realized that they can actually work much more efficient and spending 1 hour in the train each direction every morning, and property prices are starting to move up outside of London, and that potentially could be one of the impacts. But again, we need to get on the other side of really to get a better feel for that.
Yeah, actually, the taking the discussion over to big cities in London, getting ahead in the slide deck, but I think it's a key point. I'll just riff on that for a second, because I think it's really interesting what's going on in the UK now, where we have this Conservative government's effort geared towards this so-called leveling up agenda. And we're getting further signs of that, deepening commitment to that agenda with this announcement. And you see, there was a good FT article, I tweeted it out earlier, where Chancellor Sunak is talking about this new national infrastructure bank to be created, a little bit inspired perhaps by the European Investment Bank. It would be based in North England, so, you know, clearly an effort there to, again, level up from that whole north-south divide, investing in projects, infrastructure, and otherwise all across the nation, taking equity stakes in various things. And in part, the headline is it's about fulfilling the green agenda, but there were even some specific quotes in that article talking about, look, it's also about just simple smaller projects that will help smooth the flow of traffic and things like that have nothing to do with the green agenda. It's just about a big investment in infrastructure. And I think this is a very interesting signal on that front, not so much on the work from home, but just the effort. And as well, it's a sign of the further, a framework that really encourages the idea that the UK is leading the charge among the developed economies in the West, at least towards a proper MMT framework. And looking at where sterling is, all this is keeping sterling quite bid. There's a sense that we're headed towards maybe an announcement this week after waiting so long and passing so many deadlines. Cable champing at the bit there, above 133. It's at the highest levels except for a brief spike towards 135 in early September. You can see that cable slide on slide chart on slide six. And that 135 level is absolutely massive. It has it's a storied level going back to the post-financial crisis low. I think there was even back in the 80s, it was a 135 attempt there. So really watching with interest sterling this week while the dollar just sort of continues to coil around. And talking about, let's go back to our vaccine, you know, the current reality on the ground that's so grim versus vaccine hopes. We have potentially Pfizer getting the approval in the UK as early as this week. The U.S. said to be rolling out actual vaccinations within 3 weeks. And Peter, you've included the AstraZeneca. So it's not just the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine candidates. We also have a very advanced AstraZeneca vaccine candidate in the pipeline. What are your thoughts there? And also you're pointing out as well that it's less extreme cooling required for this particular vaccine.
Yeah, so they AstraZeneca just announced early this morning that their vaccine is on average 70% effective. They did see different regimens, different doses, having at the low end 63% effectiveness, but also all the way up to 90%. But the average was around 70%. And it is a slightly different type of vaccine, the AstraZeneca ones. And the great benefit that is obviously offsetting the lower effectiveness relative or efficacy relative to the Moderna's and Pfizer's slash BioNTech's vaccines, is that this one can be stored at 5 degrees, so basically in a refrigerator, and that has a huge advantage for distribution, especially in remote areas, but also in less wealthy countries, not being, you know, North America or in Europe. So I definitely see there's a market for this one, and it's another great news, I think, on the vaccine front.
Right. Well, it's going to be very interesting winter as these vaccine candidates get rolled out. Now, actually, at the weekend, the one asset that trades quite heavily is crypto. And we saw some interesting moves, of course, last week with the Bitcoin getting headlines. And it was a bit volatile over the weekend. It sort of peaked out just below 19,000. And it was pretty much sideways from the Friday levels. But other attention in the crypto space on Ethereum, which has really rocketed in recent days and really continued through higher. So we're up something like 20% versus where we were at the Thursday close. And we've looked into it a bit, and it looks like what's driving this is that we have something called Ethereum 2.0 coming, and a sort of an upgrade coming soon, which is potentially changing the game around the use of Ethereum and intensifying it, because it will drop some of the technologies that are so computationally intensive in terms of verifying transactions, something called a proof of stake concept. And I won't pretend to know too much about that, but it means that those participating in the network could actually get some yield on their Ethereum holdings. And keep in mind, Ethereum as well is kind of a platform that can be used to launch sort of other initial coin offerings, and otherwise is a very different beast than Bitcoin. But I think that Ethereum is really garnering lots of attention. This is the second largest crypto asset, and you can trade the ETN of Ethereum on the Saxo platform if you'd like to participate in this as a Saxo client. It doesn't require the access to all the crypto exchanges and wallets, etc.
We should mention that the big move that we're seeing in crypto obviously is related to that news that PayPal has allowed its users to buy and sell cryptocurrencies directly via its platform. And I saw a report over the weekend that they estimate that around 70% of all the flow in cryptocurrency, I don't know what it is in Ethereum, but I saw it for Bitcoin. So 70% of all the flow last week came apparently through PayPal. It's an estimate, so obviously there's a range around that estimate, but it just means that PayPal will all, there are millions of users and 26 million merchants, worldwide operating on the system, has really enabled this cryptocurrency, market for maybe a broader mainstream adoption.
Yeah, and there was a good article on FT Alphaville with Isabella Kaminska, who's very, very much up on all things crypto, at least related to Bitcoin, and particularly about that PayPal story is quite interesting. Also, some of these links to this so-called Tether, and whether PayPal could replace some of that. It's very interesting. It's going straight over my head, but you can follow up with further thoughts on some of the ramifications. Also, the idea that paying for Bitcoin is incredibly efficient, which I think many would challenge. I think that was pointed out in the article as well. Quite a transaction fee relative to dealing with other means of exchange. Let's drop the crypto subject for now, and then consider as well. This whole reflation narrative we've been talking about. Markets are in a good mood, but it's not directly linked to simply reflation or not. And just a reminder to have a look over at the long end of the yield curve and the safe haven yields in the U.S. where we're seeing the 30-year almost scraping towards a low for the month. And if it's getting below 1.5% on the 30-year, you can see a chart on slide 8 starting to really look like a something that needs some deeper thoughts into what's going on. I guess it would be that growth is not going to be that great in the U.S., and so we're happy to have believe that inflation is not going to come roaring back, and that the central bank, the Fed, will continue to print money so we can all speculate to our heart's content in risky assets, even while the economy kind of stumbles along and doesn't require that we have to worry about these highly negative interest rates getting, real rates getting even more negative. But that's an interesting one to follow, I think, especially if it goes below 1.5% for the 30-year. And then Well, it's not a topic we bring up much, but we talked about crude oil and gold is still trying to figure out what it wants to do. Is it stuck in the range? But cocoa suddenly getting some headlines, garnering some headlines. What on earth happened there? That's quite a weekly bar you've got on slide 10 there.
Exactly. Cocoa market is, in order to understand it, we obviously need to understand where cocoa is mainly sourced from. That's West Africa. 70% of all cocoa being consumed come from Ghana and the Ivory Coast. Early this year, these two nations, in order to raise the living standard for their small producers, introduced something called the LTD, Living Income Differentials. Difference. And there was a surcharge they're going to charge for exports. There's something like $400 a ton they're going to add on top of the price for export from this season, which has just started here in October, moving forward. Into this, we've had a pandemic, which means that some of these major cocoa producers, they have seen a loss of revenues, they've seen less demand, and they've been squeezed. And it came to a point last week where basically Hershey, which obviously is one of the major chocolate producers in the US, instead of sourcing their cocoa from Ivory Coast and paying the $400 surcharge, they went into the futures market and basically lifted whatever they could in the December, which is soon to expire. And that you can see on slide 10, the bottom right, they lifted from the spread between December and March was moved by more than $250 in a day. But so that obviously on paper looks completely crazy, but if the alternative was to pay $400, then it suddenly makes sense. And that's really why we've seen this massive move up. There's also some political instability right now in Ivory Coast. There's been an election, but primarily it's driven by this surcharge, which the consumers at this stage really don't want to pay, even though it's going to a good cause because they are struggling themselves. So cocoa is rallying actually at a time where demand is weak and where excess supplies in the Ivory Coast and Ghana is actually quite high. So there's plenty of supplies, but it's just the political infighting that's created this situation. So even though it's broken to the upside, the potential for further upside could still be there in the short term, but we probably just have to be aware that it's not because the market suddenly become chocolate lovers and we can't get enough of it. There is plenty of cocoa out there, but it's just we have these restrictions in place.
Well, thank God for that. Plenty of cocoa out there. I think that's the main main takeaway we need. Great rundown of the specifics there, and it's always an incredibly interesting with the dynamics that can affect individual commodities like that and the stories behind them, such moves. Let's look at the calendar for today and for the rest of the week. Let's recall that it is U.S. Thanksgiving week, which means most of America is offline, even as early as starting on Wednesday, but certainly Thursday and Friday. So all the stuff gets piled up onto Wednesday. And there are a couple of interesting points there besides the weekly claims. We also have the latest PCE inflation data, the key one that the Fed watches, and then the FOMC minutes, where everybody's looking towards that December meeting and wondering if the Fed is ready to ease now because of the lack of clarity on the fiscal, or whether they want to sit on their hands a bit longer to see how things shape up. I think expectations a little bit overbaked was one of the key points in a couple of my updates late last week. But we'll, of course, follow up on that as we get closer to it and see what they have to say. For now, today is really interesting because we have all of these preliminary November manufacturing and service PMI data points from both Europe, France, Germany, Eurozone, the UK, and the US later today, although the US one doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. And that's about it for today. It's been a long one. We'll wrap it up here, and we'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call for today. Thanks for joining.